I'd like to mention that I want to add to my list of minor accomplishments the fact that I got Jeff Durbin into a suit. And if you look at my attire, it was all for nothing. There's also a lesson here connected to our theme. I was trying to figure out, why would Jeff think that? Well, it's because most of the time when I'm on the internet, I've got a jacket and tie on. And so here's the lesson. Don't believe everything you see on the internet. This is Saturday. Not the Lord's Day at all. All right, so my topic is the gospel and the web, the gospel and the internet. And so I want to begin by saying I've got a lot of material here and I've got 45 minutes. And so extending the analogy, this is going to be a compressed file. This is, you're going to have to use your zip drive. But also one of the advantages of this is that we're recording these things, and if there's just too much info going there and you think you missed something, you can always go back and check later. I want you to know that I'm putting a lot of information together here, and I just want you to know that I'm not doing it by accident. I'm doing it on purpose. So the topic is the gospel and the web, and in order to begin rightly, I need to define my terms. By gospel, I mean the message that proclaims that God was in Christ reconciling the world to himself by means of the death, burial, resurrection, and ascension of Christ, and that in the person and work of Jesus Christ, God has undertaken the recreation of humanity and of human history. That is the good news. That is the gospel of Jesus Christ. The death, burial, resurrection, and ascension of Jesus Christ. And that God had a purpose in that death, burial, resurrection, and ascension. And that purpose was the recreation of humanity and consequently the recreation of human history. The World Wide Web. By the way, have you ever wondered why World Wide Web is three syllables and the abbreviation is nine syllables? WWW. Right? What a world, right? Okay, so at any rate, the web came into recognizable existence around 1990. Recognizable existence around 1990. There were a few breakthroughs before that, node-to-node communication, but the web in some recognizable form came into existence around 1990, making it around 27 years old. The printing press, a driving force in the great Protestant Reformation, was invented around 1440. And the Reformation began 77 years later, in 1517, 500 years ago. For us, our 77 years later would tally up to 2067, 50 years from now. In other words, there was a lag time between the invention of the printing press and then the first great deployment of the printing press in the Protestant Reformation. But given the nature of the technology, and given that the pace of things has accelerated somewhat, we may reasonably surmise that the next Reformation is going to explode about 6 months from now. And we wanted you to be prepared, and this is part of the preparation. In order to talk about this intelligently, I have to cover three basic areas first. I want to give a brief theology of media, I want to give a brief theology of wealth, and I want to give a brief theology of tools in order for us to understand our relationship to the internet and how our embrace of the gospel and our desire to live in terms of the gospel relates to something like the internet. We have to understand media biblically, we have to understand wealth biblically, and we have to understand tools biblically. Not surprisingly, the gospel relates to all three of these and in an integrated way. First, the theology of media. We are not disembodied souls. We can move around physically and we can bonk into things. This creates enormous theological problems, not to mention occasional bruises. I'm not just my soul. I am not just my soul. I am soul, spirit, and body bound all together. But it gets complicated rapidly. We can see at a glance that a man's hand and the screwdriver in that same hand are distinct realities, but he uses both of them to accomplish things in the world. In fact, he can tighten a screw more effectively with the tool than he could if he tried to do it, quote unquote, authentically, which is to say, by hand. For tightening a screw, my natural hand is the wrong tool. What we are grappling with is the problem of media. Man lives in an environment which he has figured out how to manipulate or use. And most of what we use, most of the environment that we use, most of the media that we engage, that we interact with, is invisible to us. It's so much a part of us that we don't even see it anymore. It's like the fish doesn't recognize how wet he is. When Adam and Eve were first placed in the garden, they were in an environment, but that environment was not yet being used. It was not yet manipulated into media. It was just out there. But that did not take long. Depending on how much time they lived there before the fall, the garden would have begun to develop infrastructure. There would be a plot of ground where they were going to grow their food, for example, and a pathway to that plot of ground would begin to develop when you took the same path out there. That's the path, that's the road. And how would Adam till the ground? How would he weed his primal truck patch? So we have souls and we have a physical world. Because God has created us as ensouled physical bodies, what he has done is given us hands to work with the physical world. But he's also given us handles out there in the physical world, enabling us to pick things up. We have bodies, which is why we have hands to go with those handles. Those handles are available, and so we are being positively invited to engage with the world. Much of this is so normal for us that we don't even notice it anymore. This is why most of media is invisible to us. This is why most of media is invisible to us. And then when something new comes up, like the internet, we say, whoa, look at that medium. Right? We can see it because it's fresh, because it's new. I can guarantee you that your great-grandchildren, the internet is going to be as invisible to them as certain things are invisible to you, like telephones or roads. We assume that we just happen to have fingernails. We don't reflect on the fact that if we didn't, it would be impossible to pick up a quarter. Why did God give you fingernails? So the girls would have something to paint and pick things up. All right? It's a rudimentary tool. Media, that which enables us to handle a world, is distinct from our bodies. Would working out from our bodies also include our clothes, other people, tools, and infrastructure? For those running ahead, the web is infrastructure. The web is infrastructure. Our first parents were clothed to cover the shamefulness of their nakedness, but we do not need to assume that clothes would never have developed in a world apart from sin. Presumably, there would have been some hikes that required shoes, and some temperatures that required warmth, and some occasions which would require majesty and glory. So working outward, the first line of media would be clothing. Then we encounter other people. Language was something we were given by God at the very first. Mankind was created as a speaking creature. Language is not something we invented. Adam and Eve could talk as soon as they met one another, which means that it was a built-in feature. In fact, when Adam was introduced to Eve, the first thing he did was to speak. Not only did he speak, but he spoke in poetry. Bone of my bone, he said. But language is part of the complex world of media. We ought not to be thrown by the fact that we think by ourselves when we're off in the woods, we think by ourselves using language. While we do think internally by means of language, this should tell us that we were created for community. Language presupposes others. And I'm so dependent on others that even when I'm by myself, I'm with others because I'm still with language. We speak and are spoken to, which means that between us and our conversation partner, we are manipulating the air with our teeth, lungs, lips, and are doing so in order to request that that other person across the table there would you please pass the mashed potatoes. The media involved in all this is largely invisible to us, but it is no less there for all that. In order to get the potatoes, You have to puff the air. And I don't know if you, there's one of the things that the internet does is enables you to see weird things. One of which I saw was, I think, an Italian tenor singing a complicated piece in an MRI machine from the side. Yeah, who thinks of these things, right? Hey, let's watch what this trained operatic singer, what his tongue looks like when he's singing from the side. Well, we think of your tongue going up or down in, you know, in or out, just a little rudimentary thing. But the tongue is like this globule, and then from the side, it's all these, every note, it's a different shape, and it's going back and forth. It's the spookiest thing you've ever seen. And you have to do something comparable in order to get the mashed potatoes. Right? You're manipulating your body in a way that manipulates the air. And the air out here, this is a medium. And so in order to get the potatoes, I manipulate my teeth, tongue, I puff the air in a certain way, and I get this reaction. Potatoes. Whoa. And little toddlers spend 2 or 3 years figuring this system out. In between us and other persons, we find other stuff as well. And over the centuries, we've cooperated together with countless others in order to configure that stuff into large-scale media. We've arranged things so that we can get the word across the planet, or so that we can get something from New Zealand into our inbox in Alabama. Think about what makes up media, including all the aspects of it that we don't tend to notice as part of a very complex infrastructure. A list of those things would include your sidewalk, your iPhone, your nearest frontage road, your coat hanger inside the doorway, your shoes, your car, the calendar hanging in your kitchen, the timer on your coffee pot, the strip where the big box stores are located, and your gas furnace, on and on and on. When you do something as simple as flipping on a light switch in the morning or programming your coffee pot, you are relying on and interacting with hydroelectric dams, power plants, the fuse box in your mechanical room, the wiring in your house, and the bag of beans you bought from the roaster yesterday. If you touch any part of this invisible spidery web, the whole thing quivers. And in principle, sensitive equipment on the other side of the world could detect it. In principle, sensitive equipment on the other side of the world could detect the fact that you had coffee this morning. The theological aspect of this is found in the reflection that all of this appears to be a design feature. These things are not things that get in the way of our essential interconnected humanness, but rather as something that expresses our essential interconnected humanness. When it was just Adam, Eve, Cain, and Abel, they did not need the internet, nor could they have built one if they did need it. Neither did they require interstate highways. And so, some idyllic dreamers have assumed that the ideal condition of man must be the primitive one, because back when we had 4 people, we didn't need all these things. Well, that's because you had 4 people, right? Why would we assume that we've lost something essentially human just because we've gotten to the point where there are 10 billion of us and we do need an interstate? Why do we assume that we have lost something essentially human when we have billions of humans? That makes no sense. God was the one who told us to multiply. He's the one. This was not going to be that important a point. And then I've got to come up with something quick. God was the one who told us to multiply, and one of the things that necessarily grows and develops with that multiplication is the largely invisible world of media. When we notice it, which is rarely, our reflex action is to worry about it, as though getting your news off a smartphone is somehow less authentic than getting it from newsprint, telegraphs, or smoke signals. There's nothing different in principle. There's nothing different in principle. We're dealing with more people. We're dealing with higher rates of speed. And of course, if you, one of the things that the internet enables us to do is move our ignorance around the world at high rates of speed. All right, so if you say something stupid, it's stupid fast. We now have the ability to be incandescently stupid. We also have the ability to project wisdom. Right? So wherever you go, there you are. Whatever it is we have, that's what we export. So that's a brief theology of media. Media is not accidental. Media is something that God has equipped us with, given to us. It's part of the world that we're put into. We have to deal with it, and we have to deal with it on the terms that God has assigned it to us. We shouldn't just arbitrarily worry about things. That's number one. Number two, a theology of wealth. When we talk about technology, we have to come to grips with the fact that we are talking about something that the Bible doesn't talk a lot about. All right? If our entire environment is media, then a rich and textured environment is wealth. So what about that? Wealth in the Bible has a bias that in this fallen world does lean towards self-sufficiency. But this is not something that the wealth does to us, but rather something we do to the wealth. Wealth that when God created the world, when God made the world, he declared it very good. This is good, that's good, this is good. The world is good. We mess it up. It's the sinfulness is something we contribute. The wealth is something that in its own right and its own status is not a bad thing. So wealth is simply and solely a good thing. It is a gift from God. The bias is what happens when the means of apparent self-sufficiency that the wealth creates. I've got a roof over my head. I've got an interstate highway. I've got an internet. I've got a good wireless, fast wireless connection. You start assuming that these things are your birthright, and you forget the God who gave you these things. And when you forget God, you become self-sufficient. And that temptation to autonomy is the problem. So the bias is what happens when the means of apparent self-sufficiency are placed in the hands of someone who has entirely the wrong attitude about autonomous self-sufficiency. To say that wealth has a bias to self-sufficiency is a figure of speech. Wealth is inanimate and has no thoughts on the matter at all, one way or the other. Wealth doesn't care. The diamonds don't care, the gold doesn't care, the stock portfolio doesn't care, and all the tools don't care. And this is my connection. The reason we need a theology of wealth is that tools are a form of wealth. And media, almost all of the media that we use would be a tool, one kind of tool or another. These things all connect. This means that to say that wealth has a bias is really to say that men and women have a bias when we look at them in relationship to the wealth that God gives them. When God gives wealth, men and women in rebellion against God have a tendency to abuse it, have a tendency to misunderstand it, have a tendency to be ungrateful for it, have a tendency to give themselves credit for it, and so on. Here's how the problem is described in Deuteronomy. When thou hast eaten and art full, then thou shalt bless the Lord thy God for the good which he hath given thee. Beware that thou forget not the Lord thy God in not keeping his commandments and his judgments and his statutes, which I command thee this day, lest when thou hast eaten and art full, and hath built goodly houses and dwelt therein, and when thy herds and thy flocks multiply, and thy silver and thy gold is multiplied, and all that thou hast is multiplied, then thine heart be lifted up, and thou forget the Lord thy God, which brought thee out of the land of Egypt from the house of bondage. And thou say in thine heart, my power and the might of mine hand hath gotten me this wealth. But thou shalt remember the Lord thy God, for it is he that giveth thee power to get wealth, that he may establish his covenant, which he sware unto thy fathers, as it is this day. Now, what do? You get all this stuff, and you think, look at me go. All right? Nebuchadnezzar looks down at Babylon and says, look at this great Babylon that I have built. That's the reaction. So we take credit for the wealth. We take credit for the gifts. We take credit for the things that we have that we just somehow assume are our birthright. We own them. I have this as my right. And so you're working on your car, let's say. You can't get something to work. You know, let's say the air conditioner doesn't work quite right. And you're working on it, and you're muttering under your breath, not realizing that Nebuchadnezzar would have given half of his kingdom for your stupid car. So he could drive around the top of the walls of Babylon and say, look at me go. And you say, but the air conditioner doesn't work. And he says, what's an air conditioner? And we think, stupid air conditioner, stupid computer, just amazing. All right, so we take all this wealth for granted. But notice what God says. The problem is we take this good wealth, and in our sin we project onto it, and we project our arrogance, our insolence, our self-sufficiency on it. But if we do that, why did God give us the wealth in the first place? Why did God give us the internet? It's wealth. It's amazing wealth. Why did God give us the internet? But thou shalt remember the Lord thy God, for it is he that giveth thee power to get wealth, that he may establish his covenant. That's why we have an internet. God wants his covenant established. God wants his kingdom grown. God wants his gospel proclaimed. That's why we have wealth. Now look closely at what the text says. It says that a host of good things are good gifts from a good God. Full meals, good houses, multiplying flocks and herds, silver and gold multiplying as well, and the same good growth happening to everything else they possess. All the good comes from outside, from the hand of the Lord. Where does the bad come from? Moses warns them about their heart being lifted up. He tells them that they are in danger of forgetting the Lord their God. From that poor beginning, their hearts are lifted up, and they lay claim to the pride of life. They say in their blinded conceit that their own hand was the source of their wealth. This is the fundamental mistake, the fundamental problem. When you look at the internet, when you look at the world of the internet, do you see there on display the pride of life? You bet. All right, it's as sassy and fat, and their eyes are fat like grease. They forget the law of God. The arrogant human heart is the source of the sin concerning wealth, but the arrogant human heart sins this way in the proximity of wealth. Wealth is not the locus of the sin, but the presence of the wealth is the locus of the temptation. Just as a beautiful woman is not the cause of lust, but merely the occasion for it, so also the presence of wealth is not the cause of self-sufficiency. But we see over and over again from Genesis to Revelation that wealth does provide the occasion for the sin of self-sufficiency. And we also see whenever something bad happens, let's say there's a school shooting or something, what do? We blame the guns. What do? We blame the alcohol. What do? We blame the drugs. We blame out. We want to blame the stuff. We want to say that sin is resident in the stuff. But no, sin is resident in the human heart, and that's why the gospel has to go wherever human hearts are making this mistake. Now, if my thesis is correct, and tools and technology are to be understood as important forms of wealth, then this gives us the rubric for dealing with our tools and our technology in a biblical manner. Deuteronomy 28. Because thou servest not the Lord thy God with joyfulness, and with gladness of heart, for the abundance of all things. Therefore shalt thou serve thine enemies, which the Lord shall send against thee, in hunger and in thirst and in nakedness and in want of all things, and he shall put a yoke of iron upon thy neck until he have destroyed thee. Notice what we're told here. The solution to self-sufficiency is not to banish the goods that we used in order to forget God. You can't get rid of the human heart by getting rid of the things that the human heart lusts after. You have to get rid of the human heart, and the only way to get rid of the human heart is by means of the gospel of the death, burial, and resurrection of Jesus. So, the solution to self-sufficiency is not to banish the goods that we used in order to forget God, but rather to make a point of remembering God in and through the abundance that he gave us. We are required to use the abundance to remember him. We are not supposed to forget the abundance so that we remember him. We're not supposed to use the abundance to forget him. We're not supposed to forget the abundance in order to remember him. We are commanded to, as it says in the beginning of Deuteronomy 28:47, because thou servest not the Lord thy God with joyfulness and with gladness of heart for the abundance of all things, because you weren't grateful. Why is this judgment coming upon you? Because you didn't connect the tools, the technology, the wealth, and the media to the gospel. Right? That's why judgment falls on a people. So, what was the problem? It was that they did not serve God with joy and gladness for the abundance. We are not only tempted by wealth, we are tempted by our temptation by wealth. In other words, we are tempted to locate the sin in the stuff. And then we try to solve the problem, when and if we do try to solve it, by putting some kind of respectable distance between us and the stuff. If people sin with alcohol, tobacco, and firearms, and they do, we think that we must regulate the substances or the tools themselves. We need to put restrictions on this. We need to put warnings on this. We need to, instead of dealing with the people. We do it like this because we can at least, we think, throw the stuff away. It is a physical thing out there, and so it appears that we can distance ourselves from it. But if the problem is in our hearts, always in our hearts, whatever shall we do? We can't throw our hearts away. We can't get a new heart. It would be more correct to say that we cannot get a new heart on our own. If I were to make a decision to throw my old heart away, that decision would have to be made by my old heart. My old heart would have to be the one to decide to throw my old heart away. And if my old heart could do something as wonderful and as noble as throwing my old heart away, what is the need for a new heart? In other words, I need to be saved by somebody else. I must be saved from outside. I must hear good news, not good advice. Good advice would be throw your heart away. Old heart, throw the old heart away. That's good advice. It's also impossible advice. The old heart can't throw the old heart away. What you need is good news, where God promises to take away a heart of stone and give a heart of flesh. When we consider the world outside ourselves, it is made up of two realities. The first is the ultimate reality of God, the one who made us, and to whom we are everlastingly in debt. The other reality is that of creation, all of the created order that is external to myself. When I am out of fellowship with God, the only thing available to pursue beside him is some sort of created bauble. And when I pursue that created thing, trying to get from a finite thing what only the infinite can provide, I have fallen into the vanity of idolatry. So, there's me, there's myself, there's God, the infinite triune God, and then there's the world. If I am out of fellowship with God, then the only thing that I can pursue as a substitute for God would be my relationship to the created world, and I can pick whatever thing I want out there. Some people pick technology, some people pick drugs, some people pick sexual encounters or pornography, some people pick respectability in the world, etc. But it's all idolatry. We cannot make the raw material of idolatry go away. God created it, and he is not going to uncreate it for our personal convenience. What has to happen is that God has to give a heart that is capable of being rightly related to him in the presence of things that seem to beckon us to be wrongly related to him. That's what the new heart does. That's what the gospel does. God puts us right, and when he puts us right with him, it is now possible for me to be right with those things that would compete with him, and always necessarily compete with him if my heart is unregenerate. This is why we must insist on the absolute necessity of the new birth. This is why we must insist that the gospel be preached in such a way that you're looking for men to be born again. You're preaching to regeneration. You're preaching to conversion. You are preaching conversion to the unconverted, and you preach conversion to the converted. We do this knowing that in every person's life, there's a point where you turn from the world, turn from self, turn to God. You turn away from sin and to God. This is gospel truth. So, God enables me to become rightly related to things that seem to beckon us to be wrongly related to him. But it only seems that way. The actual beckoning is done by us projecting our own willful desires onto the blank screen of God's good gifts. A right theology of wealth will equip us to handle tools rightly, doing everything we do to the glory of God. This brings us then to a theology of tools. We need a theology of media. The media is basically our entire environment, which God created along with us and created us to function in that environment and enabled us to manipulate that environment so that we can do more things with it. That's what God meant when he told us to exercise dominion. Incidentally, when he told us to exercise dominion, that cultural mandate was given to Adam and Eve before they sinned. And people say, oh, well, that presupposes a world without sin. But the cultural mandate is then repeated to Noah after a cataclysmic judgment on the globe for its sinfulness, for its wickedness. After Noah gets off the ark with his family, the cultural mandate is reiterated, stated over again. We cannot pretend that sin has erased the cultural mandate. Sin affects our ability to fulfill it, but the gospel restores that ability. And that means that's why we are here on the cusp of this amazing new world, where things there are glorious opportunities that are going to open up before us, and we need to be theologically prepared for it instead of shrinking back, saying, "Oh no, this is a new and scary thing. I'm not sure Christians should be doing this." This is why we need a theology of media. This is why we need a theology of wealth. This is media. This is wealth. These are tools. So, a theology of tools. Let's push this out. Because tools are a form of wealth. We learn what the Bible teaches about technology by learning what it teaches about wealth, and then we make the application across. When God gave the cultural mandate to Adam and Eve, obedience to that mandate could easily have begun when they were both naked and unashamed. They could certainly multiply like that. They could be fruitful and multiply like that. But there are other verbs in the cultural mandate, Genesis 1:28. God tells them to replenish the earth, and he tells them to subdue it. On top of that, he commands them to have dominion over the fish. Where are they? Down in the ocean. Exercise dominion over the fish. When I was in the Navy, I was in the submarine service. I remember one time in the middle of the Atlantic, we were 400 feet down transiting. We were going wherever it was we were going. And we were 400 feet down, tootling along, and I had one of these epiphanies. It dawned on me where I was. I'm down inside the Atlantic Ocean. You know, is this okay? Right? Is this okay? Well, what does God say at the very beginning, the first pages? Exercise dominion over the fish and over the birds and every living creature. Quite obviously, the very first thing Adam and Eve were going to need was tools. Quite obviously. Adam would not have been able to exercise dominion over a hedge without tools. And God told him to exercise dominion over the whole globe and all the animals in it. We are told that the descendants of Cain were the first who developed the use of tools. Jubal was the one who invented musical instruments, for example, the lyre and pipes, Genesis 4:21. And Tubal-Cain was the inventor of tools fashioned from brass and iron, Genesis 4:22. And we should note that this means the development of mining, which requires another set of tools. All of this happened during the lifetime of Adam and Eve. All of this happened during the lifetime of Adam and Eve. Sometimes people make much of the fact that the tools mentioned were developed in the line of Cain, the bad guy, the one who had gone off and built a city, a bad thing. And so we are urged to be appropriately wary of tools. Beware of tools, that's in the line of Cain. Technology has supposedly been our ancient foe. But the line of Seth culminates in the deliverance brought about by Noah, and when he built an ark, the use of tools in a project like that was not optional. This was an enormous technological achievement, about the length of a football field and half again as long after that, about half the length of a modern aircraft carrier. All right, that's the size of the ark. In comparison, all the great cities built by Cain and his descendants had this in common. None of them could float. Noah's Ark was the technological achievement of the antediluvian world. All right, Noah's Ark was an amazing technological achievement. When Noah worked the wood with tools, he was doing the same thing that Jesus did centuries later in his father's shop. And the two of them together were doing the same thing some carpenter was doing when he fashioned the cross upon which Jesus was going to be crucified. They were all doing the same thing, working with wood. And that thing that they were doing tells us nothing about the sinfulness of the activity or not. In order to evaluate a tool, we have to account for the telos, the end, the purpose. Hammers are used to build both brothels and barns. Our perennial temptation is that of locating, as I said before, the sin in the stuff. But guns don't kill people. People do. Blocks of stone don't build the ziggurat. People do. Gopher wood doesn't build arcs. People do. After the entry of sin into the world, one of the first things that happened right after that was the evasion of responsibility. Adam blamed the woman for giving him the fruit, and God for giving him the woman. And the woman blamed the serpent. Sin occurred, and excuses followed hard after. God comes down to the garden, and Adam and Eve say, well, we are prepared to acknowledge that mistakes were made. Put it in the passive voice, get responsibility away. No. When we sin with a material object, or in near proximity to a material object, the most obvious thing to us is to blame that material object. We blame guns for murder, alcohol for drunkenness, artwork for lust, etc. Tools can be simple, and they can be sophisticated. When the hammer twists in your hand and you curse the hammer, you are cursing a very simple tool. When your computer freezes up and you curse the computer, you are cursing a very complex tool. But it is folly both ways. Man is not man without tools. Man is not man without tools. It is not the case that unbelieving man fanned out into the world in search of hard metals while the descendants of Seth were supposed to eke out dominion through an adroit use of their fingernails. Notice how the children of Israel hear the land of their inheritance described to them. Not only was it a land flowing with milk and honey, it was a land rich in iron and brass. Deuteronomy 8, again, 7 through 9. For the Lord thy God bringeth thee into a good land, a land of brooks, of water, of fountains and depths that spring out of valleys and hills, a land of wheat and barley and vines and fig trees and pomegranates, a land of olive oil, olive and honey, a land wherein thou shalt eat bread without scarceness, thou shalt not lack anything in it, a land whose stones are iron and out of whose hills thou mayest dig brass. You look at what God is giving them, and you say, are tools needed in a vineyard? Are tools needed in an orchard? Are tools needed in harvesting olives? Are tools needed for digging iron out of the... Yeah, of course. The world is laden with good things, and apart from picking an apple or two with your bare hands, any kind of dominion has to be accomplished by means of tools. A man with tools is not being an artificial man. A man cannot be an authentic man without tools. It's not something extraneous to us. It's not something outside of us. This is a design feature. God has built us in order to serve him with tools. But once we've acknowledged this, we find ourselves on a spectrum. Where's the dividing line between the first stick that Adam used to knock down the first beehive and the fantastic app you just downloaded to your smartphone earlier today? We can describe the differences, but these differences have to do with traits like simplicity and complexity, and not with whether they are part of a man's body. They are both, therefore, tools. Screwdriver, stick to knock down the honeycomb, or the apps on this. Now, I want you to think about this. Some of you have heard me mention this before. It's a very important point. And that is, you got all these little apps here. If you were to go to someone like George Washington and show him this, after the first thing he would say is that this is demonic. But let's say you got him past that, right? And you asked him, so what would you need? How many servants would you need? How many servants would you need to perform this function? All right, let's say you've got a servant. Are there Anglo-Saxon libraries available, dictionaries? Yeah, he'd need a servant well-versed in Anglo-Saxon and an Anglo-Saxon library on call, waiting, right? How many servants would he need if you took an average person's smartphone, added up all the functions of all the apps that were available, and asked how many servants would it take for George Washington to have these functions at his service? I think the number is easily 100,000, something like that. Now, and you've got this in your purse. You've got this in your pocket. Hundreds of thousands of servants waiting for you to say, what are you going to say? All right. I want to know, I've got access to virtually every library in the world. I've got access to all sorts of, you know, magazines. I've got access to library. I can load books on this. Hundreds of thousands of servants. Now, and all of them are in your pocket. All of them are in your purse. Now, I do acknowledge that some of these servants are pretty stupid. Some of them are idiots, right? Just sitting around. And see, the real problem is, what would happen if you were given an opportunity, for example, to manage a grand estate, and there were 100,000 servants on this grand estate? What would it mean? What would that do? Well, you would have to learn management skills, right? You'd have to learn how to manage the servants. Because if you don't, 98% of them are going to be, you know, sitting out in the courtyard smoking cigarettes, saying, when are we going to do something? So the fact that there is available wealth doesn't mean that you've learned to manage it the way you ought to have. One of my servants just made my thing go blank. Oh, he hasn't touched the screen in a while. So, what this means is that you have tremendous opportunity, and one of your tasks as an extraordinarily wealthy person with hundreds of thousands of servants at your disposal is to learn how to employ them, learn how to put them to work, learn how to deal with it. And you're not doing anything against your humanity, either creational humanity or redeemed humanity. The world is laden with good things, and so a man with tools is not being an artificial man. A man cannot be an authentic man without tools. A woman cannot be an authentic woman without tools. So, when Adam found the stick, he was wealthier than he was before. When a man purchases an app for 99 cents, or many of them are free, he is wealthier than he was before. Tools are technology, and technology is a form of wealth. This means that we need to regard our tools the same way we regard our money, with grateful suspicion. Not suspicion of the money, but suspicion of our hearts. Suspicion of our inclination to self-sufficiency when I get a certain number of tools, when I get a certain amount of money, when I get a certain amount of wealth. Or perhaps on alternating weeks with suspicious gratitude. This has to do with the nature of creational goods in a fallen world. And the only thing that can keep it from twisting in our hand and destroying us is gratitude to God through Christ. And the only thing that can bring us into a relationship of gratitude to God through Christ is gospel. Right? Now, do we have tools in this? Are these tools available for the promulgation of the gospel? Are these tools available for preaching the gospel? The answer is self-evidently yes. And remember, 1440, the printing press, the application of printing Bibles and evangelistic literature and all the teaching, that the potential was not unlocked by the church for decades, for 70 plus years. But when it was unlocked, it transformed the world. When that potential was unlocked, when the church went, oh, we could use this to tell everybody about Jesus. Like, oh, we could bring the gospel to everyone this way. At some point, I believe that there have been some far-sighted Christians. There have been Christians who have had the penny drop for them with regard to the internet, with regard to digital technology. There are voices here and there going, oh, oh, oh. But I think that at some point in the near future, there's going to be a collective gasp from the church. Oh, I can click, right? I can write a blog post and click, and a few seconds later, someone in New Zealand is reading it. Someone in Australia is reading it. I can post, and I can go into the back page of my website, and I can call up a map, and I can find out how many people in China have read it, how many people in India have read it, how many people in New Zealand. And it breaks it down. I can go into a map of the United States and say how many people in Oklahoma are interested in what I'm doing. Okay, and I can find out within seconds. They can find out what I'm teaching within seconds, and I can find out about their interaction within seconds. They can post comments, and of course, there are going to be the devil's going to try to undermine it with trolls and bad attitudes and disparaging the potential. Oh, go, nothing to see here, nothing. Just forget about this. There's nothing but sin on the internet. No. Every technology, whether it's the printing of books, when we began to print books, bad books could be printed now. Right? That's true. When you have websites, you can have bad websites. You can have the wrong side of town. This is the wrong side of the tracks. All of that is true. But we need to be the kind of Christians who look at this and see we are privileged, and I'll end with this observation. We are privileged to be living in the generation where this opportunity first opened up. Right? This is, you are living 20 years after the invention of the printing press. Right? You are at that threshold. Now, if you'd been born, if you'd come of age 50 years before the invention of the printing press, you would have been living largely the way people were living prior to the advent of Christ, right? In the way they communicated. Again, going back to George Washington, he got around basically the same way that Julius Caesar got around. Julius Caesar and George Washington traveled roughly the same way, some horse-drawn contrivance, right? But within a short space of time, if something flips, if something turns over, there is an enormous opportunity created, and then there is the lag time when people have to gather their wits and come to a realization of what that potential is. And they're not going to, when they first dive in, they're only going to be realizing 5% of it, right? But when they get into it, they're in a position to learn the remaining 95%. If you're anything like I am, you get a new software, you know, get some software thing that you're running on your computer, and you figure out enough, it can do 95% more than what you're using it for. It's the same way with the whole technology. There are gospel opportunities that enable us to multiply our influence, to have disproportionate influence, but we can't just say something like, yay, first adapters, and run into it blindfolded. We have to think like men and women. We have to understand what the temptations are, and we have to embrace the opportunity as a true gospel opportunity. Our Father and God, we're very thankful to you for all your goodness to us. We thank you for putting us in this world at this time. We thank you for what you've entrusted us with. And we ask you to bless us and bless the rest of this conference as we're working through these issues. And we pray in Jesus' name. Amen.